Hi, this is Tom Ward from the Majestic Group, and today our guest is Dean Harrington from Southern New England. Welcome, Dean.
Hi, Tom.
Hey, some people on the call are going to know who you are. There's going to be some people on here that really don't know, you know, your background. Why don't you just give us a couple minutes regarding, you know, where you've been? I know you've been around the block a little while, but give the listeners some insight as to where you've been.
That's a nice way of calling me old, isn't it, Tom? When you've been around the block. I started a company called Shamrock Financial in 1987. It was at that point a partnership. It became a corporation in 89, and that's kind of when we really launched it and started to get things going. Ironically, as we have this interview today, the original name of Shamrock Financial was born of, you know, like any good name, 10 minutes of brainstorming and then just hoping you got it right between me and my partner back then, based on my father having started something called the Shamrock Society, which sounds really fancy. It was a fundraising group, but I think knowing my dad and his friends, it probably had a little bit more to do with drinking than fundraising, but I think they came together. In any event, my father's anniversary of his passing was 20 years ago yesterday, and, you know, I got very sentimental back then when he was in the later stages of his life, so I named it Shamrock Financial and went on from there, and it was always a great tribute to him and something that stays firmly in my mind even beyond the days where it's just his 20th anniversary of his passing. So originally Shamrock was an inside origination, kind of a direct marketing channel. We grew quite a bit, as everyone did, and reached eventual volume of between $300 and $400 million a year during refi mania. We now are entering our 21st year, and we've obviously changed quite a bit, but we're still principally the same company in terms of our culture. We always hired people from outside the industry that had great talent and brought them into the industry and said, look, this is the learning curve. It's going to take a while, but if we put ourselves in with enough talented people, we'll always have a successful operation, and for the most part, that's proven to be the fact.
Don't you find most people, that's actually a harder business model to be able to, it's obviously stands the test of time, but don't you find that a lot of people find that as a harder business model?
Yeah, you know, it was interesting. It was a real easy business model for about 15 years. And then obviously as our industry began to change quite dramatically during, you know, 05 and 06, that model no longer became practical. You really couldn't bring people in that didn't have talent. But when I'm talking about talented people, I'm talking about former Major League Baseball player, who is now the president of the company, Rod Coria, all the way through to people that ran restaurants, the people that ran discovery zones. You could have the pick of the litter of talented people. What I thought was it was easier to get across the learning curve of the mortgage industry than it was to get over some learning curve of talent that may never materialize with somebody. I also didn't want to see myself limited to a field of, okay, I'm going to expand and hire. I can only look at people with this background that have some mortgage origination background. Rather, now I can look at the entire theater. I can look at everyone and find any kind of people. And, you know, you had to take some upfront costs in doing that. Your training was much deeper, and their return to you was not as great early on, but it builds so much loyalty. I mean, you're someone that shows someone an industry and treats them right, you keep them with you. I mean, my retention levels over the years have been extraordinary, unheard of. And again, that model has somewhat changed. So yeah, you're right. It is a little more difficult, a lot more upfront expenses, but think about how many more people you get to choose from. So that's how we looked at it.
And then obviously business has changed. We're talking about probably 06-ish, right? Right now is where we're at. And how's it changed a little bit? We've had a little transition in the mortgage industry from 06 to 10 minutes ago, then 10 minutes from now, right?
But I guess if we can't cry about it, we might as well laugh about it, Tom. I mean, you've been through it for as long as I have, and probably a little longer. 06 was an amazing year for us. I never thought I'd ever look back and say that. It was probably our worst year profit-wise. 07 was a rough year as well because we were transitioning quite a bit at that point. Rod Coria and myself actually sat down somewhere probably in mid to late 06 and said, look, to survive, we need to thrive. We can't simply try survival as we go into this transition market that we saw coming. We can't wake up every day with just the passion of surviving. Can you imagine that being your life every day, Tom? All right, my principal goal when I put my foot on the floor today is to survive. And so what we said is we've got to thrive. If you want to go from thrive, from a mentality of surviving to thriving during this radically changing market that we knew we were facing, we need to do something different. And that's when we got fortunate enough to pick up the book Good to Great by Jim Collins, which I think has sold probably better than 3 million copies right now and still has not entered paperback as you and I sit here in April of 2010. The book was revolutionary for us. It was just a great, great find, and it really took us to a whole nother level.
And I think that when you go back to that, and I applaud you for that, because we've seen, what do you think we've seen? We've had to have seen two-thirds of the companies go out of business, and I think that the interesting thing that you bring up here is, and this probably goes back to, you know, a little bit of your background as well as Rod's background, but a lot of people play defensive strategies during times like that, and you guys have taken a total offensive approach to this thing and said, you know, plug in. Obviously, Good to Great is probably one of the best, probably business manuals that's out there. And I think you've taken that, just that huge aha for you. But it's interesting. I've known you for a while, and when you find something that you get in, you're all in. I mean, you don't hesitate on that. What have you done? Kind of just take us through the stages as far as what happened.
Yeah, let me
you and Rod went through that.
Let me share with you a story that I think really illustrates what has happened to us and the metamorphosis that we've gone through, and why I think today, as we sit here, we are a much better company than we were at any time when our profit was higher in the early part of the decade. Oxymoronic to think that, but we are infinitely better. And what we did is we sat down with this book and we began to read it. The first thing that the book jumps on, and for those people listening on this interview have read the book, they'll know this, that the very first thing it jumps on is it talks about the bus. Have the right people on the bus, have the wrong people off the bus. And when you have the right people on, make sure they're in the right seats. So Rod and I sat down and said, all right, well, how do we know if someone's the wrong person to be on the bus? We've never really had any scaled back staffing. We've never done any layoffs or really any contraction, but we knew we were heading into that direction with the way the market was going. We also knew that we couldn't stay as just simply an inside origination channel living on direct marketing and primarily refis. We knew that the market was going to change and that we had to transition into something else. But this bus thing compelled us. How do we get the wrong people off the bus? How do we even know who the wrong people are? I mean, instinctively you can know that, well, this guy's not as productive as this guy, or this gal isn't as good as this gal, or whatever the case may be, but it was kind of nebulous. It didn't really sit down and tell us, so naturally we did the smart thing. We kept reading the book. I always advise that. Finish the book. It's amazing what you'll learn when you actually don't stop. The thing it suggested was to determine your hedgehog. And I had never heard the term hedgehog, and it really follows a story between the fox and the hedgehog. And the fox gets up every day, and he aggressively pursues the hedgehog. And the fox is fast, he's clever, he's wily, he's determined, and he comes after the hedgehog. The hedgehog, who's the slowest moving animal on the planet, just pops up above the ground, burrows ahead 5 feet a day, sees the fox coming at it, and goes right down below the ground, puts its spines up, and the fox runs in, gets cut, runs back into the woods, and waits till the next day. Meanwhile, the hedgehog silently and quietly moves 5 feet ahead. What the book challenges you to do is to find out what is your hedgehog, what drives you, what moves you, no matter what external forces are going at you. And as you and I are having this interview right now, sitting on my desk is a little stuffed animal, tiny little one, of a hedgehog, because somebody had bought that for me 6 months or a year ago, and it just still remains there because it was so instructive for us as a company. So we had to sit down and determine what is Shamrock Financial's hedgehog. Well, what the book suggests, and we had actually had this idea even before we got to this point in the book because it just made sense, was to put together an executive council and make sure that council includes people from every department in your company, and then make sure it includes people from outside your company, referral partners, vendors that you use, and so forth, and put that group together with no egos at the door, no titles. It was keenly suggested that if you are the owner or the principal in the company, that you do not sit at the front of the table, you do not occupy a power position in the meeting, and that you do more listening than you do talking. We embarked on this probably in the early part of 07 with the idea that, all right, this should take us a couple weeks, 2 hours a week. We'll have this thing banged out. We'll know what a hedgehog is. We'll know what really drives our company. Well, Tom, I think it probably took us 30 hours. It took an extraordinary amount of time to get down to this. Well, the first thing we determined was, in looking at the book, it gives you a whole bunch of companies that have gone through this process of determining their hedgehog. And there were a couple that I always pulled out when I do a presentation based on the hedgehog, and one was Walgreens. At the time, Walgreens was in a head-to-head battle with Eckerd to determine, you know, who would be the next great pharmacy company in the country. And Walgreens determined that their hedgehog was profit per customer through convenience. So they built a model of their hedgehog that was built solely on profit per customer visit to the store. So they knew that for getting enough customers to visit the store, the convenience was the number one criteria. They did incredible things to build that hedgehog around that term. They would move entire locations from one corner of a block to another corner because that corner was easier to get into and to get out of. In many cases, breaking million-dollar leases, never mind reestablishing across the street. They then built drive-thrus, drive-thru pharmacies. They were the very first one that did it. I think somewhere in the book it is an 11-mile radius in Baltimore, or 5-mile radius in Baltimore, where they moved 11 stores. Imagine that, at that expense, to meet this convenience per customer footprint that they were looking for. Wells Fargo, who we all know in our industry, is an interesting one. Their hedgehog became, rather than like most banks and most depositories, most of those have hedgehogs that are profit per account, profit per customer, profit per branch, different profit models built on different things. They turned around and ran it like a business. They determined that they were going to have profit per employee. You can imagine that what that does to your efficiencies and your accountabilities within your culture. They actually ended up getting much smaller and not having such a global vision because it was harder to manage that hedgehog on a global vision. They needed it more to be on a little bit more isolated and contracted vision. So we sat down in this executive council and said, what is our hedgehog? Well, we knew instantly what it wasn't. It wasn't based on profit. And how do we know that? Well, we know that for a few reasons. Number one, I couldn't recite in any great detail what our profit was over the last 4 or 5 years. I never really looked at it that closely. I always term to my staff that I look at profit as the value of the W-2s that we've produced here. If we've got a bunch of people that made six figures or had excellent years income-wise, that's a good profit year. If we didn't, then it's a bad profit year. We also never made a decision based on a loan being approved or not approved based on the profit of the loan. So we knew keenly that, gee, you know, it can't be profit. If we're willing to do some loans that we don't make any money, how can we say our hedgehog is profit? So we quickly threw profit out the window. And then the next thing that the book instructs you to do, and Collins is very clear on this, and it's something that I've really personalized over the years in a number of different aspects to my own personality. Finding a hedgehog is the intersection of three different circles. The first one, what can you be absolutely the best at? The second, what is your economic driver? How do you make money? That's got to be part of your hedgehog. And third, what are you most passionate about? And the first and the third circles were to me then and are to me today the most interesting part. And when I give this presentation to large real estate groups or referral partner groups, I tell them that your broker owner shop or your own corporate culture needs to determine its hedgehog, but you need to determine your hedgehog as well. And I think one of the interesting things is, if you ever notice, Tom, we're always most passionate about what we're best at, and we're always best at what we're most passionate about. I have this thought that I'd love to be a great singer. I think I would love to be a great singer. But I'm not really good at it, so therefore I'm not really passionate about it. And I'm not passionate about it enough to go get lessons and take this thing to the next level, because I know it's not what I can be the best at. So it's a beautiful, natural little synergy that develops if you look at these three circles. What can you be the best at? What drives you economically? And what are you most passionate about? So naturally, we sit down in this illustrious group of people, and we all check our egos at the door, and we begin this think tank process of what we do. The first thing that we said is that we help people. Everything we've ever done, help people get in homes, help people lower their mortgage payments. For me, with my employees, help people find a better career. I took people from outside the industry and put them in this industry where they were able to make more money, work less hours, and be treated better. Everything was about helping people. Next natural thought is, well, how do you help people? And I found it interesting that the first thing that came up, and it came up everywhere from everybody, is you've got to be empathetic. You've got to care about them. And you, being the author of The Empathy Effect, certainly understands that importance in any relationship, that you have to have empathy. But is empathy enough alone? Is alone enough? Is that our hedgehog, that we have to be empathetic? I mean, that sounds an awful lot like a nonprofit to me. That sounds like some community activist group or somebody that really wants to care about people. We care about people, but that alone is not enough. The second thing is, how do you show empathy for people? How do you show empathy? And we all realize then that one of the best things you can do to show empathy is merely to listen to people and listen actively, listen compassionately, listen empathetically. So then I thought, gee, what are we, a church? I mean, we going to hold confessionals this week? All those things were all byproducts of our culture here and had been for years. Even when we were in the direct marketing end of things, when you're dealing with somebody that's responding to a direct marketing piece, you don't have a built-in relationship with them. So you really do need to listen well, and you need to share some, you know, you need to have some empathy. So we knew we were kind of getting around it, Tom, but we weren't really there. Something was missing. And we made a breakthrough, finally, as will happen when you put enough good people together in this type of a format. And we determined the true way to help somebody is to give them knowledge. And think about it. No matter what it is, your landscaper, the guy that fixes your dryer, the person you buy the car from, the person you buy your television set from, knowledge is everything. The whole consumer buying process is a bridge between your lack of knowledge of what to do and gaining the knowledge to make the right decision. So then we said, gee, you know what? So our hedgehog is, we've got to be Shamrock University. We've got to have this great think tank of knowledge. Well, we knew we were close. We knew we were close, but we knew we weren't there yet. We had to think about the people in our culture. Do they have knowledge? If you and I tried to exist on our knowledge from 1985, Tom, or 1993, in today's market, we wouldn't last 5 minutes. See, knowledge isn't static. So we knew that just finding people that had knowledge wasn't good enough. Our culture had to be built on people that could access knowledge or information, process it, retain it, and then dispense it. Because otherwise, what good is it? It's no good if you can't acquire it, retain it, and then dispense it. And of course, dispensing it means teaching it. So we got thinking about, well, what does that entail? What kind of person retains information that they were aggressive enough to acquire and then has the communication skills to turn around and dispense it? I was channel running one day during this process, and I ran into Larry King, watching the Larry King Show, which is not something I ordinarily do. And I was so struck by Larry's interview skills versus the normal talk radio that I listen to every day, where the talk radio guy, and I think you're probably no different in Chicago than it is out here in New England, Tom, that they come in with a pre-script of questions that they want to ask the athlete or the general manager. And at times I've heard a guy like Curt Schilling get on WEEI here in Boston and say, during his playing days, well, I did my good stuff last night, but, you know, that had to do with what happened in the morning. And, you know, you can't expect to go through what I went through in the morning and have your good stuff at night. And the interview would be, the next question was, well, how do you think you're going to be in your next start? He would completely not ask, what happened to you in the morning? Larry King didn't do that. Larry King would always ask the next question out of mere curiosity. And this quickly was a breakthrough for us, where we realized for someone to access information, retain it, and dispense it, they have to at least have a component of intellectual curiosity. So going through this whole process, we finally determined that we have got to build a culture and a company that finds, employs, and retains people that have a passion for intellectual curiosity so that we can advantage our clients and our referral partners. And we built a saying that educate and motivate, that when we educate, we motivate.
Interesting you said that, because here's what I mean. I want to just go back to something that you said earlier. You talked about getting the right people on the bus, but, you know, maybe Collins was a little bit off with that, because I think that you've created, what you just said there was, you've now found your hedgehog, and now that is going to determine who should be on the bus and who shouldn't be on the bus. Because obviously, if you've got somebody who's not intellectually curious, they have no intellectual curiosity, they can't be on your bus anymore, the new bus, the new Shamrock bus, right?
Correct. I mean, you and I have been around enough companies and employed enough people to know this type of person. We instantly looked out there and said, who lacks this intellectual curiosity? And anyone on this call that runs a company or is part of a company knows the type of person we're talking about. When they make a mistake, they say one of two things. No one ever told me. Or, gee, I forgot. I'm sorry, that won't happen again, boss. I got you covered. What happens with that guy 3 weeks later? He or she makes the same mistake and just defaults to the other excuse. If they said in the first place that no one told me, then it's just then they default to, I forgot. We looked out and found probably two of our top 10 producers were people that had no intellectual curiosity and could never retain information. Their only successful characteristic was that they had great personalities. And if you go back to Stephen Covey's book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, one of the great illustrations that he has in that book is the difference between the character ethic and the personality ethic. And he makes a pretty compelling argument. The personality ethic has been born in the last 50 years and to our detriment. The character ethic used to be what was important. Now it's become the personality ethic. Some of these guys got by on their personality. And there's nothing wrong with having a good personality. It didn't fit our culture. They had to get off the bus. Because if they weren't willing or able to digest information and then be able to teach it, be it to a client or a referral partner, they were going to sabotage the rest of the corporate culture here. Because I always say it this way, we're a potato sack race. Everyone has a leg in that potato sack. And if one of us falls, the likelihood is that several of us in that potato sack are going to fall and tumble with them. So getting the right people off the bus was easy. We did it in 24 hours. Now, it also gave us how our hiring should be going forward.
You got two of the top ten. You got two in your top ten that you determined were no longer going to be a fit for the culture that you've reestablished. And I think you probably had that somewhat subconsciously, but now with good to great, it's brilliant. So did that take any guts? I mean, think you had to have a whole lot of guts to go in there and some blind faith in the fact that this is the direction you're going to be able to go, to be able to say you're burning the boats and you're saying, hey, this is not going to be a fit, and we're going to move forward without these two people. And, you know, that's really some blind faith, my friend, and that's a breath of fresh air, you know, when you look at that. So I applaud you for that, because that had to be hard, the guts it took to do that.
You know what it was, Tom? It was a permission slip. You know, no one likes to work with guys like that. But you know what? You keep them because they're somewhat productive, and they may be good guys for your profit. But what helped me, what really helped me, is that, as I said, I built the company years ago on having talented people. And I still had quite a few of those talented people with me in 07 when we went through this. And several of them were on this executive council. I had so much confidence in their ability that when they looked at me and said, Dean, this is what we got to do. This guy doesn't fit. This girl doesn't fit. This someone doesn't fit. They got to go. There's a great strength in numbers. And when you've got a number of people feeling the same thing, it was liberating for us, because now we could look at the rest of the company and say, this is our hedgehog. We just lived it. It was blind faith, Tom. You're right. But at that stage, we were very fortunate that the market was crumbling. At that point, you've got to be inventive. You've got to think outside the box. You don't in refi mania. Why? Why do that? We're rolling along. We're making tons of money. There's no reason to really be gutsy.
Right.
But if you can't be gutsy when things are going downhill as fast as this industry was going. I mean, at one point, I think we had over 500,000 originators in this country, and it had fallen to close to 100,000. Can you imagine that? That kind of attrition? So at least we knew we had the good guys still left in the industry. Why do I keep a bad guy that doesn't fit our hedgehog? It made no sense.
Well, eventually they would have been gone anyway. They'd have been out of business, because the consumer would have been obviously competing with, you know, you're educating people, your people who are educating the consumer. They would have been swallowed up in that whole mess. And it would it might not have happened exactly. You probably accelerated the dismissal of those folks, but eventually they probably would have had to get out of the business.
Well, think about it like this. At the point that we made this decision, we were probably 90% refi, 10% purchase. And our refi stuff was almost predominantly direct marketing or former clients or referrals of former clients. That's a very one-on-one relationship in a refi. It's really us and the client. There's no buyer involved. There's no seller involved. There's no realtor involved. I mean, you're taking three cooks out of the kitchen right there. So if someone lacks some intellectual curiosity and needs to be told over and over again, and he or she is having to retell their client over and over again and they look stupid, the collateral damage isn't that substantial. But we have flipped to now being a 70% outside origination purchase model. It's an amazing transformation that we've been able to undertake in the last 18 months. Can you imagine if I had people out there? You talk, suddenly it's not a very insulated one-on-one relationship. Even now, I mean, you have challenges where maybe one particular loan originator has said one thing and reality is something else. I mean, everyone contends with that. The ability for that to catch fire and go through your referral partner network and your whole market share is so dramatic that you can't risk having those people lacking intellectual curiosity. You can't risk that.
Yeah, overnight your reputation gets tarnished, and now you've got to become defensive and retract and rehuddle and go back through all that. I want to bring a listener back to one point here that that I've just done some recent research on that I think it's so important to what you bring up. And I think you know this. I don't think this is subconscious. I think you know this. I think there's a tendency in business not to take that educational approach, primarily because of the information age that we're in. We all go out. You can look up anything on the internet and find the answer. The difficulty is that the answers that we get are sometimes the wrong answers based upon where they're published, and especially the society that we're in, especially the generation that you and I are bringing up our kids in, where that is. I think it's so important because you're talking about education, but you're talking about education by an expert one-on-one with local market knowledge, which is a far cry from somebody being able to say, well, I don't need to be educated. I'll just get that off the Internet. Some of the information we get off the Internet is wrong, and some of it is not timely, and some of it's old and depends on where it is. Anybody can be an expert, and publish a YouTube video up, and all of a sudden it's there. But I think that's the big difference of what you've done there. So I applaud you for that, my friend.
Well, that's a stunning observation that I got to be candid with you, Tom. I hadn't really thought about it from that perspective. What we've done in building our education channel is we've done it through a few different means. We've partnered with a local furniture chain that's very well known, very, very philanthropic, very charitable, big name recognition, and we've partnered with them, and we have been hosting seminars with them throughout their locations in southern New England. And the seminars can go anywhere from how to do your mortgage checkup to short sale to foreclosure to first-time home buyer to move-up buyer to whatever it might be, and it's been directed both at the consumer and the referral partner, the real estate agent, and people along that line. So we've been able to personalize it by putting it in that venue. The second thing we've done is webinars. We do 3 or 4 webinars a week on different topics, and the topics can range anywhere from how to handle objections to getting to yes, which was a good book that was written that we've kind of parroted there a little bit, to effective phone skills, to condo changes, to FHA changes, everything. And we've kind of built this university of going out and doing this in a webinar format. We've also taken on a radio show where, unlike a lot of radio shows, we're not trying to talk to the consumer. It's kind of odd. Our theory with that and our feeling with that, go back to sports radio. Sports radio, if you were listening, it's got a bunch of journalists on it, and occasionally they will interview the general managers, the players, and the people that are participating. What we decided was that we would, rather than use journalists per se, we would actually be the experts. We would actually be the general managers and the athletes doing the show, talking to other general managers and athletes. That's the analogy we use. So when we do our radio show, we're educating our referral partners during the radio show. Well, what happens? Consumers eavesdrop on that. Here's Shamrock teaching on their radio show about the FHA guideline changes, and they're teaching it at a very high level. And we're teaching it right across the board during our radio show. Consumers are going to listen to that. They want to eavesdrop to the experts talking to one another. The change thing is amazing. And you're right. The Internet is a great vessel, but it's also a limited vessel. And time, it's behind the time. It's not as up-to-date as it needs to be. And the parts that are, it'd be like looking for the up-to-date tree in a forest. How are you going to find it? You may not.
It's interesting you said that because they go back to the piece. The missing link on the Internet is purging of old information.
Yeah,
think about that.
That's
right.
A perfect
because
answer.
If I've got information in there from 2008 in the mortgage business, and somebody happens to pull that up, right? Because the guy's done a great SEO, SEO optimization. where he's at the top of the list on the list, and it's from 2008, it's wrong information because it's probably changed three times in the mortgage business.
It also may not be geographically set to where it needs to be. The other way that we've taken this university out to the streets is that we've become certified to teach continuing education credits to realtors. So we run two of those a week probably at different locations throughout southern New England. So none of this is us dropping off a rate sheet. None of it's buying coffee for anybody. None of it's back slapping and saying, where's your deals? Get us your deals. Our theory was built on a pretty simple premise that people will always buy from the person that knows the most. Not always. It's 90%. I think every study shows 90%. 10% will be driven by price and price alone. But if you and I were to go into two electronics locations, and I can't even name them now because so many of them go out of business so fast, and there were two different TVs, you know, we're looking at two 50-inch plasmas, one at one location, one at the other, one for 1,000, one for 1,050. We're going to buy from the guy that knows the most about the television. That's been proven in every study. So our thought is that if we continue to teach, we'll continue to tell our referral partners and, by association, the consumers, that we know the most.
And, Dean, you teach in an environment, and I just want to make sure I understand this. You teach in a no-holds-barred environment. You don't force the folks out there to do business with you in exchange for teaching. You, again, have some blind faith that says if you're the smartest person out there and you're educating them, you're going to make these real estate agents far more money. They can buy their own coffee. They can buy their own ads, right? Because
yes.
I think if you've gotten to the point where they can make anybody who's going to be associated and really plugs into the Shamrock Educate and Motivate program, they will obviously probably, it would be interesting to measure the W-2s, wouldn't it? Or the 1099s in their case, to be able to say who are the most successful real estate agents are probably the ones that plug into your Educate and Motivate program. Awesome.
Look, we all know, I think we all know this, that most real estate transactions in an area are controlled by the top 20% of agents. They do 80% or more of the business. I'm sure that holds true in just about every market. Invariably, and it's amazing to watch this, if I run a webinar on a Thursday morning at 10:30 and I get 50 people that actually attend and you look at them, most of them come from that top 20%. It's amazing. It's amazing. Those are the talented people. They know they need to know stuff. I was doing a presentation a few weeks ago. Actually, it was longer than a few weeks ago. And it was on the condo changes that were going to be dramatic. And there were several realtors in the audience that were shaking their heads, and we got to Q&A. Their questions were very negative. These changes, when is it going to stop? Why do you guys keep changing these guidelines? Blah, 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 blah. I stopped in mid-sentence because, again, I'm not there to win their business. I'm going to win their business by knowing the most, not by kissing their ass. So what I said to them was, change is your friend. It's every time there's a change and you have the opportunity to learn about that change, you distinguish yourself from your competition dramatically. If there were no change and everything was the same, like it was in 02, 03, 04, anybody could do what you do, and everybody would be doing what you do. So change, every time there's a change, we have a meeting here, we run out and say, okay, who's qualified to teach about this change, and where are we going to teach it first? If all the changes stopped, Tom, I'm afraid we wouldn't have this intellectual curiosity,
I think we ran into the program. When you talked about 500,000 mortgage originators being in the business, it was an order-taking environment because it was so static. I mean, there was no change. You could screw up, and 3 days later you could fix it. Today, that's no longer the case. If you select the wrong mortgage person or the wrong real estate person in today's day and age, there's no more mulligans. I mean, it's redisclosure. It's a matter of there's no income verifications for the liar's loans that are out there to fix some of the problems that are out there. So it's a tougher environment, and that's why we saw shrinking from 500,000 down to 100,000, because the order-taking environment's gone. In any business, as soon as the business gets to the point where it becomes stagnant and static, and everybody can get in there. I mean, in Colorado, you didn't have to have a license. More people would originate loans in Colorado than could drive back in the old days, because they had to have a license to drive, but they didn't have to have a license to do a mortgage, so they could be doing your tune-up and doing your 1003 at the same time. So that's cool. Hey, go back to something that you said earlier, which I think is a huge takeaway. you talked about the electronics store, and you know, I had done some research on the whole Circuit City demise, and that was probably one of the ones you were referring to. In that Circuit City demise, part of their demise was the fact that they had to, I don't recall what the number was, it was in the thousands, but some consultant came in, determined that they were paying their people average hourly rate was too high because they had some smart salespeople that were there. And I can remember today of going into a Circuit City rather than a Best Buy because the kids were smarter there about the knowledge of that product. And what happened was they laid those people off, and it couldn't have been 12 months later that whole company, you know, went down the tubes. And that was a huge problem.
I'm so glad you brought them up because, ironically, they were one of the good to great companies. And in late 2007, they completely broke path with their good to great hedgehog. And I don't know why. It's probably consultants. And they ended up firing all 3,400, you're right, all 3,400 of their sales staff because they thought they made too much money. So what they ended up doing was, of course, everything's economics. As soon as you cut everybody's pay or get, they tried to hire some of them back at less pay, they went elsewhere. The reason they were making so much money is that they were good. And they were good because they knew stuff. And the whole company collapsed within a year after that. It's an amazing, amazing, you talk about a mistake. And you talk about a mistake that, it would, you know, it's funny, Tom, it would have flown in the face of my hedgehog. But I can't recall what Circuit City's hedgehog was, but it had something to do with profit per location. It had something to do with, I'm going to go back and look that up. So they were a good to great company that fell apart. And it's amazing. Hey, you know, when you were commenting a couple minutes ago about how static information was and how anybody could do it back in the early part of the decade, I got to say something candidly that I say to people when they look at me. I like my career a whole lot more now than I did then. Absolutely love my career. And I got to say, in 2002, 2003, we had some tremendous profit. We were knocking it out. We were killing it. I didn't like my career as much then. It didn't feel, you talk about the things that you're passionate about and the things you can be the best at. For me, that was teaching. And how much teaching are you doing when you're closing that many units that quickly?
No time, no energy. You couldn't find a real estate agent, you know, to be able to teach to them because it was an order-taking environment. And no different than your mortgage people. It's like saying, I can't be in the conference room. I got to go do a 1003.
Yeah,
that's so cool to hear you say that because it's really interesting to hear. And Dean, I'll tell you this. You know, I've been in the YPO groups and I've been around the block and, you know, I've been around guys that have got, I saw them with 27 franchises and 27 individual stores and now they're up to 1,400 stores and I've seen it. What you're building there is a great company. It's not a great mortgage company. It's a great company. And I think that's a real tribute to where, and I think you're probably learning as much from the outside of the mortgage business. Obviously, Good to Great wasn't a mortgage book, but and I think what you've done is you surrounded yourself with, and I know Rod personally, and you surrounded yourself with some great talent, and those people are keeping you focused. Can you imagine how you'd have turned to those people in a conference room being able to say, oh, I feel really weak, I can't let those two people go? They'd have lynched you. You'd have been dead.
Yeah, they would have. I'm blessed. You know, you've heard me say this. I'm blessed with the people I work with. I really am. I have people in my operation that I'm very proud of that are better than I could ever be. And I don't say that just to be falsely humble. They're extraordinarily talented people. And that I get to be around them and hopefully sustain them and hopefully lift them up with my passion for teaching and for the industry. What keeps me driving and moving every day. I'll tell you one other part of this that people are surprised when I tell this. You and I went through, probably back in 07, a conversion of my company platform into OTT, One Transaction Thinking, which is your baby, and it's been a huge, huge, huge part of our conversion was to begin to look at things from an OTT standpoint. Well, I've actually become, I think I'm a pastor now. I don't know if I've gotten to bishop status, Tom, but I'm close. I'm at least a pastor or a reverend now in the religion of OTT. Such to the point that I've actually taught it and continue to go back and forth with competitive mortgage companies about how to run their operation. And why would I do that? Well, it's pretty simple. There are a lot of mortgage companies out there that are still operating under a broker platform, and I don't believe that operating under a broker platform is going to sustain them for the future. I don't think that platform is viable. back in 99 when I made the conversion, began to make the conversion to a banker platform here at Shamrock, it was because I thought someday they're going to shoot the brokers. They're just going to shoot them. They're going to cut them right out of the industry. It took longer than I thought it did. Than I thought it was going to. But we're getting close to that point. And that every legislative move is gun-sighted right at brokers. So I naturally have approached them and have acquired a couple of talented broker shops in our operation where you're really acquiring the people more than the assets or the liabilities. And in doing so, obviously Good to Great has been a tremendous, or just the whole hedgehog experience has been a great way to communicate that. But the other thing is I teach them the OTT stuff that we've gone through. And then I teach it to other broker shops and go back and forth with them about their financials and what changes to make. And there are people who look at me and say, why are you doing that? Because I know that platform's not going to be relevant. And when that platform's not, where are these talented people going to go? They're going to go work for the guy that they...
Also, they trust you. I mean, there's a big trust factor there, and you're just a good person. I mean, think about it, what you're doing, which is the golden rule. I mean, you can roll it all the way back to biblical times, and whether you're religious or not, bottom line is you're treating people how you want to be treated, and I applaud you for it. That's why we get along, because I think we give, and ultimately we give without having any strings attached to it, and then what happens is it automatically comes back to us. At least the good will come back to us. If I'm going to be listening to this, and let's just say I'm a real estate owner of a company, whether that's and we can put an enigma, we can put an umbrella over these people, say they're Keller Williams or Remax or Century 21 or whatever it is. Eventually, the blood, sweat, and tears is from the individual entrepreneur. Yeah, it's a franchise, but they live and die with their own profitability. Shouldn't they hire you, or not hire you, shouldn't they invite you in? Couldn't you help them create that whole advisory council hedgehog mindset and dig deep down inside their soul and give them some architecture for that? Couldn't you do that?
It's one of my big hopes. I'm really hoping that we can get that far with a bunch of the broker owners in the southern New England market, Massachusetts and Rhode Island mainly. I've done the presentation. I've told the story, if you will, in 10 minutes, 12 minutes, 13 minutes. But what I'd like to do is sit in an advisory council with them and develop the hedgehog. And I've thrown that out, and it's moving towards the front burner. I think it began on the back burner, but I think it's moving towards the front burner. And I'm excited about it because, again, it gives me a chance to do what I want to do, educate and motivate. So
and I think
how do you lose there?
The hard thing, man. You know how we went through it with the whole one transaction thinking thing. I mean, it's almost like admitting the fact that you don't have a hedgehog, and you know you should have one. So first part of that part becomes admission, that says, and some people view that as a sign of weakness, but it's really a sign of strength for them to be able to engage somebody else in the outside. I think the entrepreneur is an amazing human being in the fact that, they live and die with some of the decisions that they make. They have a tendency of not having any outside counsel, and that's not by design, but more by habit, and it's just interesting to be able to do that. So I that would be neat to be able to see you're changing some lives and you're changing some cultures. And some people will choose, my views are the fork in the road with price versus value, and I believe that you got to choose one of those, and you can't be both. I think that's where Circuit City's demise came in, is they felt as though they had to compete with Best Buy, and they could have gotten market share because their people were smarter, and they eventually would have gotten it if they would have just, stayed the course. So it's got to be hard at times, especially in the beginning. I mean, right now, you've got to be almost reaching the tipping point, because in a market as you're in southern New England, there's going to be a point in time that everybody will know that, and they'll be coming to you, which is, probably a great thing for you as well as a great thing for them, and you're single-handedly cleaning up the industry with the right information that's out there. So I applaud you from an industry standpoint, from a nationwide perspective. This has been a great interview with you. It's one of my most fun because of we know how each other think, and I think it's just been something else that people can really listen to. And I would, as you get this, I think there's so many people out there that could hear this just from a company perspective. It could be a local architectural firm that listens to this and goes through that. So I think that you'll see some real strength coming out of this, and you'll see a household name. Just remember the little guys from Chicago when you reach the big time. So you can,
you know, remember them. I'm gonna thank them, or at least most of the people from Chicago. Not all the people from Chicago, but I'm blessed, and we just want to keep this ride going with staying on our hedgehog. I mean, that's the biggest thing, is not getting away from the hedgehog, staying true to it, and don't limit it. You know, if you can teach or you can talk to anybody, you know, we became a member of Lenders One last year, which is a national co-op of mortgage lenders, and that feeds right into our hedgehog, because we get to share intellectual curiosity with them. And, you know, I would say anybody listening on this call, I'd be happy to discuss our hedgehog process in greater detail, assist in theirs, talk about OTT. So if anyone has an interest, all it does for me, it's not just altruistic. I don't want to seem like I'm doing this just for altruistic reasons. Of course, that's a big part of it, but the bigger thing is it sharpens me, it sharpens my company, and it will come back. It'll come back somewhere, somehow to you, and it has already, with us being able to go from a company that did 10% of our business as an outside platform to doing 70% in 18 months to becoming probably the fourth largest direct lender in our market, from being probably not in the top 30. So I don't want to, it's not all altruistic. It's working for us, Tom. And
yeah, congratulations on that.
I'd be willing to help and jump in with anybody that would like some Q&A and back and forth on this, or even attend some of the webinars we do.
Yeah, neat to hear that. If somebody wants to get a hold of you, how would they go about getting a hold of you?
Several different ways. Easiest way is probably dean.harrington@shamrockfinancial. dean.harrington@shamrockfinancial. You could also hit me on my cell number, 401-640-5880. Or right through the website, which is shamrockfinancial.com. We're also a big Facebook group. Shamrock Financial has its Facebook fan group, so they could jump on Facebook and check us out. I'm also on Facebook, Dean Harrington. So a number of different ways. Too many ways to reach me, Tom.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, my friend. It's been a pleasure. It's so cool. And you're already getting this, so it's neat, because as a teacher, which you know that's my passion as well, that's why we're so much alike, as a teacher, to see somebody else taking the thought process and everything they've learned and teach it again, it really fulfills, both of us as human beings. And, you know, we get it down 3, 4, 5 layers, we'll make some things change, and I think that's and change for the good. I think it's just that we tend to get lulled to sleep. You know, you flash back to the .com era, everybody thought that was the new era. But at the end of the day, you still had to make a profit to be able to sustain your company. And,
of course.
Same thing here, where all of a sudden you're looking at this, and that's where the Internet is probably the greatest asset we've ever had. And with the lack of purging of information, it becomes the greatest weakness through some people. And if you can't, you get a little bit of sleep on that. So I'll stay tuned to what's going on there, and I really appreciate your time, my friend. Thank you so much.
Well, the appreciation is all mine for everything you've done in my career and all the inspiration you've been for all of us on this side of the fence. So thank you, and it was great chatting with you today.
Bye.
Thanks, Tom.